Welcome to Grumpy Strategist, episode 50. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by a returned head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer. Marcus.
Well, it's good to be back, Michael. Back in the bunker, I was experiencing too much of the great outdoors up there in the Northern Territory, but here I am back safely ensconced, deep in the bowels of the Brindabellas. But it's a special occasion today, Michael, because it is episode 50.
Yeah, it's an Alan Border of an episode, not a Don Bradman. So 50, not 100, but still not a bad waypoint to have reached. And I have to say I've enjoyed all the episodes with you. So
Well, I've enjoyed some of the episodes with you too, Michael. But 50, it's kind of like perfect midlife crisis number. I think we're entitled to go out, maybe buy a Harley Davidson, ride around on the Harley Davidson for a bit until we crash and end up in the hospital while we have our first SAA, Grumpy Strategist Midlife Crisis.
Well, to me, 50 is the new 30. So, you know, I'm going to get a long bonneted E-type Jaguar sports car and drive around, preferably red, but it's not a substitute for anything.
We're not going to go there, Michael.
While you were sleeping, surrounded by man-eating crocodiles up in the Northern Territory for 4 weeks, quite a bit has happened in the world. Some things.
What have I missed?
Well, some things have even happened in the land of Australian defence.
Wow. Okay.
But starting with what's happened in the world, I think there have been some really interesting indications of where US defence strategy is going.
Okay. I think you'd have to say more indications, because before I left, there had been some pretty clear indications already.
Yes. Well, the pattern is continuing. So if we... We started a bit closer to home. There are some things about the US in the Indo-Pacific that I think we've seen while you were surrounded by interesting bird life and man-eating crocodiles. So the US has halted a $400 million military aid package to Taiwan.
And why do you think they've done that?
Well, I think it's tied up with the other thing that the US is doing, which is a deal on TikTok, the big Chinese app that 170 million Americans, mainly kiddies, use, because...
And the previous administration was concerned about this. So the Biden administration had basically said to TikTok, you have to divest your Chinese ownership and get American ownership.
Well, the thing is, how much sensitive data about Americans does it harvest, and how invisible is the algorithm? And the algorithm is at the will of the Chinese company, ByteDance. And that means it's at the will of the Chinese Communist Party, because they can reach in and tell companies what to do at any time as a matter of law. So it wasn't actually Biden that started US moves to ban TikTok. It was Trump in his first term.
So the previous administration.
The old Trump. Yeah. And then Congress passed a law saying that TikTok had to be divested by ByteDance, the Chinese company, and go into American ownership, including the algorithm. That was March last year. But that is getting in the way, and so is the Taiwan military aid package. And what's it getting in the way of? A deal-making summit between US President Trump and Chinese President Xi. So it looks like a deal that satisfies the Chinese on TikTok is now in place, and suspending the aid package to Taiwan also doesn't rain on the parade. And I'm not talking about the big military parade in Beijing. I mean the parade of
people.
Were you
at that? Because I believe a number of Australians did attend that big military victory parade.
Well, I saw one person who isn't a friend, Dan Andrews. He was there very proudly with the world's autocrats. I thought Bob Carr had a really fantastic stand of principle. He accepted the invitation to Beijing and the invitation to the parade. He wrote glowingly about the regime that runs China before he left. And then when he turned up in Beijing, he pulled out of going to the parade.
Oh.
You cannot get a more principled stand.
I'm going to accept the trip there, but I'm not actually going to go to the parade.
Because he might have paid his own way.
Could be some awkward photo ops there. But okay. The point is, while some former Australian politicians were at the Victory Day parade there, you weren't.
I wasn't there.
Okay.
And I one of the reasons I wasn't there was I have no time for the Chinese Communist Party that runs China or the other autocrats and dictators that Xi Jinping had gathered along with Dan Andrews.
It was a rogues gallery.
Yes, except for Dan Andrews. And also the view of World War II history that the Chinese government was putting out, that it's all down to them, they won the war.
Oh, so you're saying the Chinese Communist Party did not defeat Japan?
No, they didn't. The Chinese nationalists defeated Japan and weakened themselves in the doing of that. And then the Chinese Communists beat the nationalists in the Civil War.
Yes, because the Chinese Communists took a rather strategic approach during that war, which was to not help the nationalist government fight back against
the
Chinese.
Yeah, well, have a united front, which means we pause our war while you beat the Japanese. In fact, Mao thanked Japanese leaders after the war for enabling his victory against the nationalists. There are two reasons I wasn't there, but Dan was, so that's nice.
Anyway, that was a bit of a digression. Yeah. Getting back to TikTok.
What does the Trump administration seem to want? They seem to want Donald Trump doing some very large positive business deals between America and China. And they're willing to compromise on support to Taiwan and on the national security issues around TikTok to achieve that. And the takeout I have for that is, I don't think the American administration is committed to collective deterrence of China. I think they're committed to creating the conditions for large business deals between America and China, headlined by Mr. Trump and Mr. Xi.
Well, the previous US administration, when it put out its national defense strategy, this term deterrence, you know, was repeated ad nauseum. So it was integrated deterrence. So I know integration is one of those trigger words that does set you off, but
not as much as interchangeable.
Everything about that national defense strategy was about integration, not just within the US military, but with partners and allies. So integrated deterrence rested upon the US working with partners and allies in the Indo-Pacific to deter Chinese aggression. I would agree with you that we seem to have moved on quite a long way from that.
Yeah, we've moved to an America first strategy of peace through strength, and it's peace through unilateral American strength, an exercise of unilateral power by America, with the iconic case of that being Trump's decision to bomb Iran and destroy alleged Venezuelan drug smugglers with military means. Yes.
And deploy troops in US cities somehow to eliminate crime.
Yeah, but all this fits with the trajectory we're hearing about the new national defense strategy the Pentagon is putting together that's going to prioritize homeland security as the top priority. Within that, there'll be border security and the Golden Dome Defense Initiative and other things, whether it's China or the Middle East, are lesser order priorities. So this track is quite a confronting one for an ally like Australia that has placed all our bets into the future on collective defense with America at the center.
Well, it is interesting because at the sort of high level, strategic level, that certainly seems to be the messaging out of the US, and I think you're reading that correctly. On the ground, we still seem to be seeing a lot of kind of interaction. So we just had a very large Talisman Sabre exercise, you know, more partners than ever, more participants than ever. So, you know, on the ground at least, things don't seem to be fundamentally changing. How do you reconcile those two?
I would disagree. I think the Europeans are the, since you're a bird watcher, canary in the coal mine. So what's happened in Europe while you were sleeping is the US has suspended the Baltic State Security Initiative, which is about US military assistance and partnership with the Baltic States in the face of Russian aggression.
You mean that area of Europe that borders right on Russia and the war in Ukraine, and that has experienced a number of drone incursions recently that NATO partners have actually had to shoot down.
Yeah, yes, so I get it.
Is that what you're talking about?
You're up in the Northern Territory for 4 weeks. You tell me you couldn't return my calls because you're out of connection range, and now I find out you know about the Russian drone and fighter incursions into Poland and the Baltic States.
I was just trying to find a polite way to say it. I had limited time, and I couldn't actually read everything you sent me, Michael.
So you're right. Those incursions by Russia into Estonia and into Poland happened. And the American reaction, well, aside from ending the Baltic State Security Initiative, was to leave every other NATO partner to step up. So the Italians, the Germans, I think the French, all stood up and said extra things to protect Poland and the Baltic states. Said nothing.
Getting those slackers to stand up probably isn't a bad thing.
But the point is, when does an alliance matter? It's when your security is being actively damaged. Mm-hmm. When do you want your big partner to step up and help you? In those moments. Mm-hmm.
And there has been, on related to that, some reporting about US missile exports to NATO states have been put on hold. Because why? Well, the US need is greater. This is one of our favourite topics. We've been talking about this for 50 episodes, that one of the problems with having a defence industry that can't produce the things you need at home, you have to import them. The exporters' needs will always come first. And we're seeing that once again happening right now in Europe at a time when the European NATO allies desperately need missiles.
Well, and you're a fan of Flivberg when it comes to complexity. But I'm a fan of Goldblatt when it comes to the theory of constraints. The idea is there are just binding constraints that affect systems. Whatever you wish to happen, the constraints have effect. And we're just seeing the constraint of limited US defence production is now a binding constraint.
So are you saying that a lot of our defence strategy is based on wishful thinking?
Well, it's based on assumptions that we know are no longer true.
Yes. Yeah, so the takeaway from this is this: the things we've been seeing for ever since the return of Donald Trump to the presidency are continuing unabated, and that there is a fundamental shift in the US's strategic and defence priorities. The good thing is Australia has learned from this and is fundamentally changing its strategic and defence policies. Am I right?
I think you're right about everything beyond the defence policy, because that's what the Prime Minister has been doing with his re-engagement of China and saying, look, we know you put coercive trade measures on us during COVID.
You didn't take our lobsters.
Didn't take the lobsters or the wine. The good news is that's all behind us, and we now need to double down and grow the economic dependency Australia has on you.
Because we have shared values.
Well, the Premier Allen, the Victorian Premier, is on a business trip to China at the moment.
Everybody's in China at the moment.
Well, she wasn't
not just
sure.
Former Labor politicians, but current Labor politicians.
She wasn't sure if Dan Andrews was still there or not. Okay. But she came out with a line that the Victoria-China relationship is based on shared values. She actually said that.
Wow, that's probably news to a lot of Victorians. I suspect it's also news to the Chinese Communist Party, because it is ruthlessly cynical. It does not blind itself with these kind of fairyland expressions.
I think the Chinese Communist Party officials she's been meeting will have been absolutely bemused and taken aback by that statement, because they would not see that the Chinese Communist Party has any shared values with a democratic government in Australia. So the fact that Premier Allen thinks that is amazing, but she did something about that. She actually signed a memorandum of understanding between the Victorian Education Department and the Chinese Ministry of Education, presumably so that the shared values taught in the Chinese system can be brought here to Victoria and to our children.
I'm a bit flabbergasted, because I thought a few years ago when we sort of appeared to be getting a clearer view of the Chinese Communist Party and what it was doing around the world and inside Australia, we thought those Confucius Institutes that it had set up here in Australia to teach Chinese culture and language here weren't really a good idea, because they were actually a bit like a mouthpiece for the Chinese Communist Party. So what you're saying is we're sort of going back to that?
That they were a form of state propaganda from the Chinese. Yes. We're going back to that, but okay, in a bigger way, because yep, those Confucius Institutes, one of them, I think, was attached to the New South Wales Department of Education, and that was quite controversial, and the New South Wales government then ended that when that became public. But it's great to see Jacinda Allen so out and proud with the shared values she sees between her government and the government in Beijing.
Mm.
I'm willing to back it with an education program for our youth.
Okay. So does that mean Jacinda Allen supports China annexing the South China Sea? Does she share those values?
I think what she'd do there is, when she was asked about she thought that Chinese Australians were great navigators of the relationship, and she was asked, does that mean Cheng Lei and Kevin Yam, the sanctioned Hong Kong dissident who's now an Australian, helping you navigate the Australia-China relationship? She said that was a question that the federal government should ask, should answer.
So the hard stuff the federal government has to deal with, but the signing agreements to get buckloads of cash, that's hers.
That's hers, exactly.
Area.
So I think on the economic front, the Albanese government and their partner in Victoria is recognising we just need to get in as tight as we can with the Chinese. And maybe that's a way of distancing from America and Washington. It kind of looks like that.
Well, but this is, again, an issue we've spoken about before, because the government keeps saying that US military power has preserved peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific, and that's a good thing, and they would like that to continue. So we are in this situation where we want to have our cake and eat it. Meanwhile, the two pillars of our foreign policy seem to be diverging further and further. So I'm still struggling to see the inner coherence here, unless one of those pillars they don't actually believe in.
Well, and then, so let's talk now about US and Australia. I think the big picture for the defence plan is all about the numbers, and you've unpacked these numbers in the defence budget analysis in that defence dollars and decisions publication on
free download from the SAA website, people.
Yeah. And there, your analysis says, actually, Australia's already deeply dependent for our everything about our military on American weapons and systems. And in the next 10 years, we're getting even more dependent, because 70% of the new investment money is going to US defence company systems.
And AUKUS will accelerate that.
Yeah. So at a time when we're doubling down the economic dependency on China, with Mr. Albanese and now Premier Allen maybe going even beyond that, I think the shoe hasn't dropped on the defence strategy, because we're banking on American power and collective defence at a time when America is moving to America first unilateral strength.
Yeah, I'm still struggling, as I said, to find the coherence in our foreign policy at the moment. So we're doubling down economically on China. We sort of say we're doubling down on the US alliance and reliance on US military technology. Meanwhile, the US itself is saying, we're not too sure about this whole collective security thing anymore. So you guys may need to do more to look after yourselves. And if you do want us to stick around, you're going to have to increase your defence spending. The good news is, while I was away, our defence budget seems to have gone from 2.05% of GDP to 2.8% of GDP overnight.
I can't believe...
How did that happen? That's huge bucket loads of cash.
The media in this country, I cannot believe they have not praised Richard Miles enough for this massive increase. I mean, that is got to be about a 40% increase in Australia's defence budget that Miles has achieved overnight.
The bigliness is hard to comprehend.
And this is with the full support of Treasurer Chalmers, is right behind this increase in the number.
So what are we spending it on?
Well, there's not any actual new money for defence in the increase.
So he did say that if you use NATO's accounting for defence spending, then you actually get this 2.8% number. Did Mr. Miles actually explain how you come up with that number? Like, what's in it now?
Look, he's got
what
people.
New stuff is now in it?
Richard Miles, he's the Deputy Prime Minister. He's a busy man. He's got people to do that for him, and I'm one of those people.
Me too. So I've tried to actually unpack this number. This is a classic government announcement. Well, it wasn't an announcement. It was sort of a throwaway line in a radio interview. And it's like, well, it's actually 2.8% if you bothered to look.
Yeah, I'm not that into it, but we're actually spending 2.8%.
I won't actually tell you what that 2.8% is made of, but my take, and we can compare my take with your take, is the only way I can kind of explain this is if we are including something like pensions for servicemen and women.
Look, for too long, we haven't recognised that the tip of Australia's fighting spear, the samurai sword edge are our elderly veterans. The defence, the Veterans Affairs...
They have served their country well, Michael.
They have, but they're still the tip of the fighting spear. And we are giving DVA, I think, $16.2 billion mm-hmm. this financial mm-hmm. year to support 350,000 veterans and dependents. And that is part of the lethal weapon that is our military. So when you add that in, I think you get more than that 2.8%. I think you get around 2.9%. So,
well, there you go. We're spending 2.9%.
This is a crazy increase that Mr. Miles has achieved out of nowhere. The great news is it hasn't even affected the budget balance.
No, it's great. I mean, look, on the one hand, you go, well, if NATO is saying they want to spend 3.5% and they're including stuff that we're not including, you sort of go, well, okay, is yep. it a fair comparison?
And NATO does apparently include retirement pensions.
Yeah, the problem is once you start including things like pensions, everything gets very fuzzy very quickly because every country handles that differently, it accounts for it differently. So things do get pretty fuzzy there. The other issue is that even if it is 2.8%, it's not 3.5%. And as we know, NATO recently agreed that it would set a target of 3.5% of direct defence spending and a total 5% once you add in a bunch of, again, fuzzy other stuff like things related to resilience. So potentially fuel farms or rails that supports mm-hmm. moving your military around. But mm-hmm. whichever way you cut, slice and dice it, when 2.8% is not 3.5%.
Well, no, and my measure for this is a results-based measure, and that tells me when you've got your audit office saying that your Navy doesn't have the funding to maintain their surface mm-hmm. ships and there's so much pressure on everything other than the AUKUS submarine spend and the Hunter frigate spend, however you slice and dice it, you're not spending enough to afford your current plan.
Correct. And the other way to look at it is the figure for this year, using that boring old way of describing defence spending, the boring old thing we've been doing for the last, you know, time immemorial.
That's been in government documents for the last 40 years.
Yes, that boring old number.
Yep.
For this year, it is 2.05%. Now, okay, that is teeny bit more than what it was last year, but as we have pointed out previously, the Australian Defence Department budget has sat between 1.9% of GDP and 2.1% of GDP for about 7 years. So we've sort of swung in that little zone for about 7 years. It's essentially remained static. So despite the language about record peacetime increases to defence spending, that money is still out in the future. So this government's been in power now for, you know, 3.5 years approximately. We've still barely moved the dial on defence spending.
But the interesting thing is the government keeps announcing and getting the credit for expenditure that is a decade away and using it as a continual distraction mechanism.
So did I miss another defence spending announcement? Tell me about it, Michael.
Well, another classic case of this is the Henderson Maritime Precinct. So we had the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, who's also still the Defence Minister, Richard Miles.
Busy man.
Hard hats in Henderson in Western Australia.
Actually in hard hats. Did they have shovels?
They had jackets. Yeah, they look...
Normally there's a shovel and there's a turning of the sod.
Yeah, the sods were there for sure, but not. I didn't see any...
They weren't being turned?
No, they weren't. They were unturned. And they're there in hard hats at Henderson announcing $12 billion. Yeah, $12 billion of new money.
New money?
New money to be spent to create the Henderson Maritime Precinct.
Okay.
And that would include a maintenance, depot-level maintenance facility for nuclear submarines. So it's an AUKUS announcement mm-hmm. of $12 billion of new money.
So this is new money. Okay, so this is in addition to regularly scheduled spending. So what period is this money being spent over?
Sorry?
What period is this money being spent over?
Well, the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister weren't clear about timeframes, but it is over... 10 years. They did
So that's about an average of $1.2 billion a year. new money. So that must move the dial.
I think that's 3/200 of the Australian annual defence budget. So
3/200 of the...
Yep.
Yeah, so this year the defence budget is $59 billion. So let's say we add in $1 billion. Though I don't really think they're going to be spending on any of it this year. But hypothetically speaking, if you got $1 billion out the door this year, that would be an increase of 1 point something.
They can't get it out this year. That's because, unfortunately for the announcement, Defence has already told the public that they're spending $127 million on concept and feasibility studies.
Last year, Michael. They must have finished it.
It doesn't finish till sometime in 2027. None of that $12 billion, I don't think, can be spent before those basic concept studies are finished. So can't start being spent till after 2027.
Well, but the media release said they're going to spend that money somehow in a way related to building the landing craft.
And the frigates.
And the frigates. But I thought the landing craft thing had all been agreed. And I'm just getting my timelines a little confused here, Michael. So did the government say who's actually going to own that shipyard that we're going to spend all this money on?
Look, they were very clear that the financing options and the delivery options were still being worked out. They were very clear on that.
Okay, so they haven't worked out what they're spending it on or how the schedule to spend it on, how it's going to be funded, but the answer is $12 billion?
No, the answer isn't $12 billion. Also, in the Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister's announcement, they said that independent advice at this point says Henderson will cost around $25 billion.
So what's the $12 billion?
It's a future notional place marker down payment that won't happen for years now against a bill that's over double that at least.
Right. So how do they know it's $25 billion if they haven't actually finished this initial package of $127 million of scoping studies?
Well, I don't think they do, but my experience of initial cost estimates on almost anything about defence is the later, more informed cost estimate is higher.
So, sorry, you just admitted that your initial cost estimates are bad.
Yes.
Well, so, and it's all your fault.
I take responsibility, but so, yes, so the government proudly announced a notional future allocation of $12 billion
to future activity. New $12 billion.
For activity that has not been defined or scoped and how it's being financed and delivered has not been worked out, and their initial understanding is the thing that they're proposing to do will cost more than twice that.
Right. So I'm still struggling to work out what's the difference between the 12 and the 25, but I don't know.
25 is a bigger number than 12.
Biglier number.
I think you've gone down this unfortunate rabbit hole that people have, and I've been criticised for this too, so I know how you feel. And I got criticised for pointing out this problem about the fluff and mirrors involved in the $12 billion.
Fluff and mirrors?
Yes.
Worse than fluffy smoke mirrors.
I got criticised for thinking about political and economic issues and not getting the big picture. So you've just got to get the big picture here, Marcus. This is $12 billion of new money around AUKUS, and it shows we are all in and the progress is being made, all right? There's progress here. You wouldn't get the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister in hard hats unless things were happening. You see what I mean?
The timing is kind of interesting. But this is the cynic in me coming out here. So, you know, what we do know is that the US has been saying, the US administration has been saying, you guys got to spend more. We also know that a review of AUKUS is happening in the US. It seems to be taking longer than we initially thought. But some senior defense people in the US are maybe suggesting that this deal isn't as good as it possibly could be for the US. And one of the problems, by the way, in the implementation of AUKUS is the Aussies are a bit slow in getting stuff done.
Well, my friend, they've got another thing coming, haven't they? $12 billion.
Here we've got this announcement that kills multiple birds with one stone. Yep. We're increasing defence spending.
Yep, new money.
We're doing stuff at Henderson. AUKUS-y. Exactly what we're doing is not quite
clear. It's AUKUS-y.
Clear.
It is very AUKUS-y.
And it shows our commitment to AUKUS. And by the way, down the track, when we do build this depot-level maintenance stuff there, the US is going to be able to use it to maintain their submarine. So it's just win, 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 win.
It is. It's only when you look behind the curtain that you have any trouble and the whole thing evaporates. But up to that
point. But other than that, it's
good.
Other
than that. So another good piece of news. We're probably running out of time, but who said that the Australian Defence Force wasn't into the small, the smart and the many? Yep. I think I said it. I'd like to apologise. Because while you're up in the Northern Territory, the government has announced $1.7 billion over the next 5 years, not 10. This is a five-year announcement.
Mm-hmm.
$1.7 billion being spent on Anduril's ghost shark. If you didn't think it was real, there was a big black slab-sided prototype called B2.
I thought there were three of them.
But the one in the photo is B2.
And I think, is there a B1?
There's a B1.
But they're not yellow. In blue and white
they're
stripes.
They're not yellow. They're black.
They're yellow. Yeah. Okay, disclosure. I have a part-time, well, casual arrangement with another company, Sea-Tier Robotics, that makes large uncrewed underwater vessels. So I'll just declare that.
Oh, can I make a disclosure?
Yes.
I have no financial interest in Sea-Tier Robotics, and nor does SAA, despite Mr. Comroy's office's attempts to pretend I have.
I will also point out that I get the same hourly rate from Sea-Tier Robotics, regardless of how many submarines they may or may not sell. So what I will say is, first of all, I'm actually a big fan of Anduril because they are bringing disruption to the overly cozy arrangement between the US and Australian defence departments and the global primes.
Yep, but they're the new prime on the block.
Yeah, they're a new prime on the block. They are bringing disruption. You know, congratulations to them. Well done. They are getting a very large contract of a scale that normally doesn't go to people who aren't the established. So good for them. I will say people have asked me, so what does this mean for Sea-Tier Robotics and its Speartooth system, which is a sort of more affordable system? I guess my response to that is a couple of things. First of all, in the IIP, there is a line for $5 to $7 billion
undersea autonomous
yep. systems. This Ghost Shark announcement is 1.7, so there's still a lot of money there, one would hope. So,
well, I would note the IIP is over 10 years. This is over five years. So I'd say the Ghost Shark is going to get a few more big bites.
That may be true, but basically, when you look at the funding available, there is still money there. So there are still opportunities there for any company, you know, not just Sea-Tier Robotics.
There are a number of Australian companies making great stuff.
You know, and the other thing I would say is the ocean is a very big place, and particularly when you look at it in three dimensions. And just as in the air environment, in the land environment and the maritime surface environment, we have a range of platforms, both crewed platforms and uncrewed platforms. We have small ones, we have big ones, we have medium-sized ones, all doing different sorts of things. There is a lot of space in the undersea environment for a range of uncrewed underwater
vessels.
It's
like the old Liberal Party. It's a broad church.
It is a broad church. All I would say is congratulations to Anduril, but this is not the be-all and end-all of undersea autonomous systems.
I'm happy to congratulate them too, because I think it's a breakthrough, and it is an underwater autonomous system. I hope it works. I hope that Miles is right when he says there will be operational systems in the water operated by our Navy in 2026. But the idea that this is affordable mass and helps solve Australia's problem of a tiny number of highly skilled people with exotic, incredibly expensive things we can't afford to use or lose, it doesn't. The announcement and the talking points that Mr. Miles used were about dozens of these. Let me send him a memo about numbers. Dozens is not volume. Dozens is a tiny number. So, you know, the Russians are firing 800 drones, much smaller, much cheaper, at Ukraine every night, using, losing and replacing them. The small, the smart and the many is not dozens. It's hundreds and thousands.
Sure. You know, I don't think Ghost Shark is meant to be the small, the smart, the many of the disposable kind of system. I see Ghost Shark more in the same category as Ghost Bat. You know, so Defence has said they see Ghost Bat, this system that's meant to operate in conjunction with crewed fighter planes and other crewed aircraft. They're aiming for sort of a target price around 10% of a traditional fighter, which is still in the $15 to $20 million a pop. And so I see Ghost Shark in that kind of category.
So to me, defence has a long way to go to get the mindset right about volume. Dozens ain't volume.
I mean, and the other thing I'd say, and again, not a criticism of Anduril or Goshark per se, but again, this culture we're sort of in of non-disclosure out of the government and defence is, we have sort of learned a few things about Ghost Bat and the operating concept and what it's potentially going to be used for and how it will operate with traditional crude system. We haven't really heard anything at all about what Ghost Shark is actually going to do.
Well, we've mainly learned about Ghost Bat, the Boeing product, through a series of denials from the government and then disclosures by industry. So the fact that it's still on track to be armed was a company disclosure after government obfuscation.
Well, the government has now confirmed that.
Yes, after the company made it clear, the government probably breathed a sigh of relief that it didn't have to say something sensitive.
Back on the Ghost Bat thing, there has been some interesting statements. So there has been a statement, I believe, by the government saying that they're actually going to test fire air-to-air weapons off Ghost Bat this year, which is... Yeah. I find really forward-leaning because in sort of in the space of arming drones, it's generally been air-to-surface weapons. So air-to-air is actually, if it happens, is kind of a big leap forward.
Yeah, yeah. So look, Ghost Shark goes back two good steps, but the world of high-volume, low-cost disposable is not them. Now, before we finish up, we've got two other great points about Australian diplomacy. And the good thing, whatever you think about the alliance and the Indo-Pacific, here at home in our neighbourhood, things are great with the Pacific family, except when they're not. So we've had two events that are hard to see as anything other than setbacks for Australian diplomacy and bilateral relations with our South Pacific family.
And one was about a volcano, or it was near a volcano.
Yeah. Well, both the PNG and Vanuatu agreements that our Prime Minister flew to those countries to sign have not been signed.
A bit awkward.
I think both of them had ill omens around them by the way they were set up.
The Vanuatu one was meant to be signed on a volcano.
Yeah, it was a bilateral security agreement worth about $500 million to Vanuatu. Apparently it was pretty much a done deal, and the Prime Minister flew there on his way to the Pacific Island Forum. The signing ceremony was set up, and yes, there was a table with a lovely fresh white tablecloth on the lip of an active volcano in Vanuatu with Penny Wong and the Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, and Vanuatu government people. But the one thing that didn't happen was the agreement getting signed.
And why did it not get signed, Michael?
Look, there are just a few other wrinkles and details to be worked out. But I think the answer is Chinese political pressure and money. Because there was something in there about infrastructure and I think something about consultation with Australia before big other deals were done with other partners. And for some reason, some people thought that might be seen as competition with Chinese cash.
Or maybe excluding Chinese influence and cash.
And Chinese money's big in Vanuatu. Mm. So that one didn't get signed.
Mm.
But then the Prime Minister bravely flew to PNG with the same big feathered quill he had that it was still not actually sort of baptised by signing an agreement.
Was that one set up on a volcano?
No, this
so
one
no
was, I think it was going to be signed in Port Moresby and no active volcano in Port Moresby itself. You'd have to go out of town. But the idea of signing a big Australia-PNG defence treaty at the time of PNG's 50th independence celebrations, when they're celebrating independence from
Australia. But you're hinting there may be some neo-colonial overtones here.
Yeah, so one was on the edge of an active volcano. This one was during a kind of resurgence of PNG pride in sovereignty, looking back at Australia not controlling it anymore.
So you're saying there's a metaphorical volcano going off
here. Yes, bubbling away that the Prime Minister got flown into by the defence and foreign affairs diplomats who thought this was the moment. And it wasn't the moment. We heard all kinds of excuses like, oh, well, the Papua New Guinean cabinet couldn't get a quorum because they're all off celebrating independence. That was perfectly understandable. But nobody thought about that beforehand, apparently.
If I was Albo, I'd be going, Milesy, mate, what are you doing to me here? First of all, I get rejected in Vanuatu. I've been rejected in PNG. to sign this treaty that you announced you were working on back in February of this year. I'm expecting you, mate, to have all your ducks in a row, you and Penny. And basically, I am rejected. Well, it's a bit humiliating. And now the poor guy has gone off to DC, where he's been working to get a meeting with the Trumpster. And oops, it kind of looks like that one has fallen over as well. He's got to be thinking, give me a break. What do I have to do to win a trick around here?
I agree. I think three in a row now, leader interactions that have just turned to custard. There's no way of looking at this as a set of Australian diplomatic and security triumphs. This is bad management. And we're just hearing about the non-Trump Albanese meeting because Mr. Trump's a busy man. He's only got time for the Argentinian president and the Ukrainian leader and the leader of the EU. And he's only able to spend time at the White House with the Turkish president later on. So you'd understand that he doesn't have time for the Australian alliance partner. And we're hearing this was all part of the plan. But
it was all part of the plan to not have a meeting with Donald Trump.
I know Mr. Albanese has said direct leader-to-leader meetings are so important and they're foundational. That's why he's put the time he has in with China and Xi Jinping. It's why he flew to the Pacific, because those connections are fundamental to advancing our interests.
Right. So how many meetings has he had with Xi Jinping at this point?
Four.
How many has he had with Donald Trump?
None.
Okay.
Yeah, we're in great shape. I think the main thing is just to keep calm and carry on, really.
Well, there is a lot of carrying on going on. Yet another sort of rather concerning episode.
Actually, no, there is a piece of good news.
The good news. Give me the good news.
The UK Defence Ministry has announced the commissioning of the sixth of their seven Astute submarines.
Yes, so they're back to six. They were down to five for a while because the last of the previous class, the Trafalgar class, was decommissioned. So they are down to only five. That was part of the reason they, for extended periods, could not get a single SSN to see. But now they're back to six, because they've actually fudged it a little because...
Well, wait a minute. This Astute has taken the longest of any of the Astute class to build.
A mere 12 years, Michael.
So it's taken 12 years and now they've commissioned it. So what is the problem?
Well, this idea that normally you commission a vessel that's completed its sea trials to show that it can actually go to sea and do warshipy kind of stuff.
Well, you've got to know it works. Exactly.
So this one actually hasn't done its sea trials yet.
This one hasn't done its
sea trials. No, so they're commissioning it before the sea trials. So that total kind of construction time and, you know, entry into service time is actually even longer than the 12 years, which is the longest.
How long would the sea trials take? Are we talking about 6 months, 12 months?
Year and a half.
18 months.
Yeah, something like that.
Right. Okay, so it's good news, but it's also another statement about the difficult state of UK submarine production.
It is difficult news about that difficult state, which has implications for us. It also raises a few concerns about Submarine Rotation Force West, so the rotation of US and a UK submarine through Fleet Base West in Western Australia, because that's meant to start in 2027 and it's meant to include a UK submarine.
So this could be. I'm going back to
my... A bit tricky if they've only got five, maybe six boats to send one out here for an extended deployment.
There's a pig Latin saying in law that seems to operate here. It was mainly around property law, but it's called the Nemo Dat rule. And the Nemo Dat rule is you cannot give what you do not have. So if you've got bad title in property, you cannot pass good title to someone. So the Nemo Dat rule as applied to SRF West is the UK will not be able to rotate a submarine through there because they do not have a UK submarine to rotate through there.
Good times.
All right. Well, welcome back, and I'm pleased that you're now securely in the bunker.
I'm not sure I'm happy to be back because not that much has changed.
All right. Well, anyway, welcome back to the bunker.
Great. Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening.